My name is Layla. I'm 21 years old. I started doing meth when I was 17. I never thought I would go to prison, ever. I was a good girl, a good student. It was the biggest mistake of my life, and I regret pushing my family away from meth. I lost healthy relationships that I needed more than my relationship with my drug dealer boyfriend, who mentally and physically abused me anyways.
What do you know about meth? To get the full story, ask at methproject.org.
Good morning, everyone.
Long Talk Radio.
Good morning, everyone. Do shadows lurk in your life, perhaps in the form of discouragement, frustration, debt, fear, abuse, heartbreak, addiction, or loneliness? This hour, I invite you to leave the darkness and step into the light. I'm your host, Patty Sheen. My guests today are husband and wife Karen and Peter Bodie, outdoor enthusiasts and authors who will share what they learned, not only from their research, but what God taught them as they explored a unique and exciting facet of Colorado history. Go grab a cup of coffee, settle into your favorite resting spot, and we'll return in 1 minute when Karen and Peter will join us on the show.
There is a candle in every soul, some brightly burning, some dark and cold.
You're listening to Step Into the Light with Patty Sheen.
Who brings a fire, ignites a candle, and makes his own.
This is the show where Christians share their walk from darkness down a sometimes long and lonely path to the light of healing and fulfillment through faith.
Seek out the hopeless, confused and torn, and hold out your candle for all to see. Take your candle and go light your world.
Right here on Blog Talk Radio. Good morning again, and welcome back to Step Into the Light. So glad to have you with us. Well, Peter and Karen Bodie of Littleton, Colorado, are authors who have worked together on books about the outdoors. Their latest are a couple of nonfiction works entitled Lost Ski Areas of Colorado's Front Range and Northern Mountains and Lost Ski Areas of Colorado's Central and Southern Mountains. Both books reveal the story beneath the story of skiing in the state and would delight the reading taste of any skier of Colorado or Colorado history buff. Do you enjoy unusual historical facts? How can a project like this reflect a Christian worldview? How has the publication of these works blessed the authors? You want to stay right here at Step Into the Light on Blog Talk Radio for answers to these questions and more. Welcome, Karen.
Good morning, Patty. Thank you for having us.
Well, you're more than welcome. Welcome, Peter.
Hello. Glad to be here.
Good morning. I'm very excited to have both of you because I have never hosted two guests at once before. So this is a first. This is a first for me. So it's kind of exciting that we're able to do that.
Yes, it is. We're excited to be with you.
We'll try not to all three people speak over each other.
I'm bad about that. I'm the one who is bad about that. I wish I could see faces and then I could know who's speaking and when, but it doesn't work that way. Karen and Peter, both of you, if one of you wants to start, how long have you lived in Colorado?
Well, I moved here when I was 17 to go to college, and I had grown up in Connecticut. And that was 1972. And Karen's lived here her whole life. And her family's been out for people, so she's explored all kinds of parts of Colorado. And I came along, and fortunately we met and got to explore a lot of it together.
Well, it's kind of neat that you should say that, Peter, because you and I are in a similar situation in reverse. In reverse, because I grew up in New York and moved out here to Colorado in 1973. My husband, on the other hand, lived here in Colorado all of his life. So it's kind of interesting. My My kids used to say, "Oh, Mom, it's so romantic that you had to come halfway across the country to find my dad." But as we were discussing before the show started, you guys are in an entirely different part of the state than I am. Down here where I am, there, you don't see a lot of the mountains. You can see Pikes Peak as you head to La Junta on Highway 50 on a good day. But I'm pretty much on the plains. But as with most of Colorado, we are very rich in history down here. So mm-hmm. you guys said that you had been down this way, and I'm sure that you have found some fascinating things down here.
Well, we've been all over and found dinosaur tracks near you, and the history of Bent's Fort and petroglyphs and all kinds of things. So we've been pretty much everywhere in the state. I've been in every county except one.
I will tell you, one time a group of us got together and we had to obtain permission from the ranchers down in Baca County to go do some exploring, and we did. And well, actually, this couple from town, she had grown up out there in that country, but the property didn't belong to her family anymore. So we actually had to get permission from the people that owned that property to go on that land. And we were out there, we were doing some hiking, and we came across these dinosaur tracks that, as far as we knew, were not registered with the state. Well, Karen and Peter, Colorado is loaded, as we were talking about just now, with history of the American West, from the cowboy to mining, and famous people like Kit Carson and William Bent embellished the past in our state. But you, the two of you, chose to explore and write about lost Colorado ski areas. What motivated you to pursue that facet of Colorado history?
Well, Patty, I grew up with the ski culture. My dad was a ski fanatic, and he took us skiing every weekend in the Woody station wagon.
Oh, do you know how lucky you are?
I know. And in fact, he did the advertising for Vail Resorts when it first opened. He had an advertising agency in Denver, so we got passes, and I got to ski Vail the first weekend they were open. So that was fun, but I had gone to the Castle Rock Writers Conference. I volunteered there, and I met the History Press editor, and I was actually presenting a project of my dad's that he'd written before he died to her, and she said, "Well, you know, we're interested in somebody who would do books on the lost ski areas of Colorado," because they had a series going, started on the East Coast, and so she asked me if I'd do that. I said we'd done hiking books and of the whole state of Colorado and so on. And so she was interested, and she offered me the project. And we signed the contracts and said, "Uh-oh, what did we do?"
The initial contract said to produce two books, because there's so many lost ski areas in the state, it was going to take two books to document it all.
Wow.
We had the first contract said to do two books in 8 months, which proved to not be quite realistic, but we did complete two books in just over a year, so that was a lot of work.
Oh, my goodness, I guess so. You guys were super busy. Not only did you have to do the research, but you had to do all the writing and the editing as well and get mm-hmm. it in shape to where somebody would want to buy it. Oh, my. Wow.
We did it for the History Press, and they were really good. I have to give them kudos because they were good editors, and they were cooperative with us. And when we needed more time, they gave us a little more time. And they did a great job on the covers, I think, and so on. So it's been a real blessing.
Yes, I have pictures of your covers on the – we have a slideshow on the Blog Talk Radio site, and mm-hmm. you had sent pictures of your covers, and they're on there. Yeah. Well, if you would, give us kind of an overall view of the history of skiing in Colorado. If someone had asked me if there were lost ski areas, I probably would have said, "Well, I doubt it." So tell us not only the recreational aspects, but there was a practical need for it as well, as I learned from researching you guys.
Well, skiing really started in Colorado with some of the first immigrants from Norway and other Scandinavian countries where they had a skiing tradition and what we would call Nordic skiing. And in Colorado, that really happened earliest up in some of the mining because of the crazy miners going higher and higher in the mountains to find silver and gold and whatever. They're just harsh winters, deep snows, and skis was just a practical way to get around and get into things. And, you know, there's kind of a famous itinerant preacher named Father Dyer who used to carry mail over the mountains on skis as part of his sort of circuit. He would visit and bring religion to the mining camps, and so he also carried the mail to make some extra money. And so it started with the mining and the loggers, and then people just decided that, you know, they want to have fun, and especially in the winter, there's a lot of times when you could be just stuck in your cabin, and so they figured out ways to have fun, and they started to, you know, race each other and have little get-togethers. And and then in 1911, the town of Hot Sulphur Springs decided to have a winter carnival, and it was the first winter carnival anywhere in the western United States, I think. And they built a ski jump, and so in the teens and 20s, it was all about ski jumping. They would have Nordic skiing, but also ski jumping, and that was the rage. That was like today's X Games in a way. And then what we think of as downhill skiing or alpine skiing didn't really arrive until the 30s. It wasn't even invented until the 1930s over in Austria. And so that started to take hold and spread. And ski jumping still was popular in through really into the 50s. There were many ski jumps around the state. But then alpine skiing after World War II really took off, and then the late 50s and the early 60s and into the 70s is when all the big resorts that we think of today came into being, and the little ones all disappeared at that point. But it really started as a craze with the ski jumping way back in the teens, 1910, 11, 12, 13.
Well, speaking of ski jumping, Peter, my dad grew up in up in the Saranac Lake, Lake Placid area in New York. And, of course, Lake Placid is famous for the 1932, the 1980 Olympics. And I've been to the top of the 90-meter ski jump a time or two, but never in winter, only in spring and summer. But I can remember my dad saying, anybody that would stand at the top of this thing with nothing strapped to their feet but a pair of flat boards planning to go down this hill has got to be out of their mind.
Yeah.
But I always thought that would be, of all the sports there are, I always thought that would be the most fantastic experience. I never got to experience it. I skied some up at Monarch. That's where my kids and I used to go because it was closest to this area down here, and I never was a fast skier. But I used to think, oh, man, if there is any experience, it must be absolutely outstanding in the sports field. It's got to be ski jumping. So have either one of you done it?
Well, I almost did, but I chickened out. But we spent the winter of the 1980 Olympics, we spent it in Steamboat Springs.
Oh, wow.
And after those Olympic Games, a whole bunch of those Olympic skiers came to Steamboat Springs and proceeded to set all the hill records.
Oh my goodness.
But there's been the ski jump in Steamboat has produced a lot of Olympic ski jumpers, and I got to go and stand up on the slope and mark distances, and sometimes I would go up there and sit under the jump, and the skiers would go off the jump over your head. And
oh, how
so
neat.
I have stood at the top of that one, but you could take a class in Steamboat, a night class, on Tuesday nights, and I kicked myself that I never signed up for that, but I thought about
yeah.
it.
Yeah. Well, I still have dreams of going skiing again. I don't know. It's been years and years. I would never try the ski jumping at this age, but I'm not even sure I should try anything beyond the bunny hill at my age. But it's still a dream in the back of my mind that someday I'll get back up there again. I'm wondering, though, when you talk about, for example, the man who carried the mail on skis,
yes,
did they have downhill skis or did they use more of a cross-country type ski?
Oh, they called them Norwegian snowshoes, what they
called
them. And they were long boards that they made. How long were they, Peter?
It could be up to 8 or 9 feet long.
That's pretty
yeah.
good size piece of board to have out in front of you.
Few inches wide. Yeah, and they created them themselves, and then they didn't turn. They went straight.
So if there was a tree in the way, you were in big trouble, huh?
Yeah, absolutely.
Oh, my. Well, tell us, how did you go about doing your research? How did you even know where to begin researching? I can't imagine how you would even know which libraries to go to or whatever. So take us through that, if you would.
Okay. Well, we started with what was already published. Fortunately, there were a few. There are some people who are really devoted to finding the information on the lost ski areas, and they had put out a poster, and they put there is a website called ColoradoSkiHistory.com, and they had started publishing information on all the lost ski areas that they had, and so we started there, and we went to the larger history museum in Denver, and then just started talking to lots and lots of people. Peter's especially good at that. I'm a little shyer. I'm the writer. But Peter is really good at talking to people and finding out. They'd say, now go and talk to this person or go and talk to that person. And it was just a trail. And what
so
was
you
remarkable.
You got several leads.
Yeah, the Lord would just put people in our path, which was just, that's how we knew this project. That's part of how we knew this project was from him.
Yes.
Is because he would just, there were all his serendipitous little points in the journey that he would put a person, bring us into contact with someone that had all the information that we needed. And then we would go to the areas. We traveled to all the little and found the areas, which was fun. We loved traveling Colorado. Then I would go to the Forest Service office and talk to them and get photos from them because they're in the public domain, their photos. And then I would go to antique stores. I started going to antique stores and looking for images, found postcards, and I found some other things. I went to a postcard show at the fairgrounds and found a book on the found some little things at the postcard show, and then I just kept gathering the images. We started going to the small history museums. That was the big break in the whole research process, was when Peter talked to Tim in Hot Sulphur Springs, who runs the museum there, and that just showed us the route to getting all the information, because these little history museums in all the little towns around Colorado are just like, they're like gold. They're a treasure. They have
all
the
these little nuggets.
And they can tell you, they have not only the photographs that you can use. We had to pay them a little bit to support the museum, or we would join the museum. And then we could use their photographs in the books. And also they knew all the people, so they would tell us, go talk to this person or that person also. But then I also went looked at the old newspapers. There's a historic newspaper site. I think it's through the Denver Public Library.
Yes.
And that was so valuable. And I found a bunch of little quotes that I could put at the beginning of our chapters, which are really fun. And so, and then Peter found all the GPS points.
Well, I do, for my work, I I actually do some history in terms of looking at water history of Colorado, water rights and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
So I use aerial photos, old aerial photos all the time. And so I knew how to get aerial photos from the different government sources. And so some of these, even in slow-growing Colorado, dry Colorado, the trees grow slowly, some of these little areas were so old that literally the trees had grown in and you couldn't find them. And I would get old aerial photos and find the old ski runs.
Wow.
And then once that pinpoint, and then we went to, I think between the two books, we have about 130 that we document. And we went to all but a handful of those.
Oh, my goodness.
And there were only maybe three or four that I couldn't find the location. But everything else, pretty much I found the precise location of where every one of these was, and we visited almost all of them. Now, many of them are on private property, so we had to sometimes look at them and maybe occasionally put one leg over the fence to get a good picture.
And hope somebody wasn't waiting with a shotgun in a window somewhere, right?
Right.
Goodness. It amazes me how you can gather all of this information, both of you, from so many different sources and put it together in a book, not only one, two books. And I just wanted to shout that out, that I think you guys are amazing to be able to do that.
Thank you. We've tried to be very careful about the sourcing and citing, and we had a historian tell us that we'd done a really good job on that, so appreciate that.
Wonderful. Well, I know you have been on a couple of other radio interviews, and they are available on your website. And there were a couple of stories that really caught my attention that, if you don't mind, I'd love to have you relate here. One is
sure.
A story about how a dog managed to be responsible for shutting down a ski area. Could you tell us about that?
Yeah, that ski area was called Cowboy Peak, and it was located at the edge of Oak Creek, Colorado, which is in northwestern Colorado, a coal mining town. And the Lions Club had developed a ski area on a hill right in town, and then later a local rancher, the Sweetland family, right at the edge of town, agreed to let the town and the Lions Club operate a ski hill. And it was called, they named it Cowboy Peak, which it really was just a hill, but but a lot of people had a lot of fun there, and they would lease their part of their ranch to the town for $1 a year. And usually when the Lions Club was in charge, that the dollar got paid. Sometimes when the town was in charge, it didn't always, they couldn't even send the check for $1. But anyway, I think it was in 1985, so this had been operating for at least 10 years on their ranch, and before that, another ski hill had been operated.
Let me interrupt a second. Did you say 1985?
Yeah.
So it was, okay.
I'm pretty sure that's
it was late, okay.
Recent. Yep. And so it's one of these little community hills, you know, mostly just for the kids, and they had a rope tow. And anyway, one day in the winter, the family's dog, a basset hound named Casey, got loose and wandered down to town about a half mile away to town, and was caught sitting on the steps of the city hall and by the dog catcher. and so they got the call, and we talked to the wife when we visited their ranch, and she was still upset about it, you know, 30 years later.
My.
So instead of just somebody saying, hey, call them up, come get your dog, they issued a citation. And so they had to come into town and pay the $20. But then they said, oh, and there's also a $5 court fee for the fine. And they said, well, we just paid you the $20. We're not going to court. Why is there a court fee? And they just refused to pay it. And they went back and forth, and then they just said, fine. and they went up and shut the ski area down and put up a sign, and that was the end of ski area all over the docks. And it was just the principle of they had been doing this thing for the town kids for 10 years.
Right.
And, you know, donating their land, basically, and that they were, the town was going to pay them back by insisting on this silly fee. And it was just this little straw, you know, that broke the camel's back. There were a few other issues, where, like not sending the $1 or something. But anyway, it was just, it's just one of those things where people take a stand, and then that was it.
Goodness.
That was the end. And it made a story in the Denver Post, and I think it made one of those interesting little national stories, you know.
Probably.
The internet wasn't as popular then, but it made a national story of this, how a basset hound shut down a ski area in Colorado.
And how people can treat each other, too, you know, kind of yeah. Sad in a way.
It is a little sad.
Karen, I believe you had mentioned that your grandmother had witnessed a ski area in Denver that kind of encouraged Denverites to just fall in love with skiing. Could you share that with us, either one of you?
Sure, I could share it. I'm not sure if she witnessed it, actually, but she lived in what's a really popular part of Denver now called Highlands. She grew up in Highlands, and when she
was a
little girl.
Which had a nice sledding hill, by the way.
Yeah.
Oh, that's always fun, sledding.
Yeah, there was a big snow in 1913 of 57 inches in Denver, and in 1 month, in December. And so the town was just shut down. And I have a picture of my grandmother and her two sisters standing amidst the snowdrifts. And on the back of the picture, it says, Big Snow, 1913. So I discovered that picture while we were writing this book. Anyway, during that snow, the town was just totally shut down, as I said. And there was a Norwegian in town, a bricklayer working in Denver. His name was Carl Halson. And he got out on his skis in the city and was skiing back and forth. And a man named George Cramner saw him doing this, and he came out and he said, what are you doing? And can you teach me to do that? And so Halson did teach George Cramner how to ski, and from that, Cramner started the Denver Ski Club, and that started the passion for skiing for Denver. And then Halson was what we call the Johnny Appleseed of skiing, and he took it all around the state. He called it the very healthful sport. He wanted to spread it everywhere he went. So he started in Denver at Inspiration Point. He put on a show of ski jumping. He was quite the ski jumper, and the Denver Press Club set up an exhibition, and 20,000 people came out to watch him jump on that hill, and so that started the whole thing.
Wow. Well, Karen,
and
I want
Carl
to apologize.
Halson.
I'm not sure. I lost my connection to the show, but when I came back, when I finally got back on, you were still talking, so I'm hoping for the sake of our listeners that there was no interruption from you. That was really weird. So if there was an interruption, I apologize to you guys and to listeners, but maybe it was just me. It was just weird. I got a message on my screen that said you were no longer connected, and they finally reconnected me. So let's hope that that did not affect listeners in any way. So
anyway, well, Denverites fell in love with skiing during the big snow of 1913. They saw a guy skiing on the streets of Denver. He put on, it was Carl Halson, and Halson Hill and Steamboat is named for him. And he spread skiing all throughout the state. But he started with a jumping hill at Inspiration Point, which is on that little intersection where I-76 and I-70 split in Denver. There's that hill. You can see it. It's a famous hill even now, but people jump there.
It's a little
for,
city park.
Yeah, people jump there for several years.
So Carl Halson had earlier started a ski jump at the 1911 carnival in Steamboat Springs. And
oh, hot
then
sulfur
someone,
springs.
And hot, I mean, it's hot sulfur springs, sorry. And then someone who came to one of those carnivals kind of stole him and took him over to Steamboat Springs, and that's where the ski jump today is still operating. And Steamboat Springs created a winter carnival, and theirs is still going over 100 years later. So that's – but Carl Howelson really, really inspired people, especially for the ski jumping craze.
Well, that's very interesting. And I was going to tell you, now, a lot of these ski areas had didn't even have rope tows or anything. Is that right?
Well, early on, they just – people would just climb up the hill and ski down, the very early ones. And then the rope tows started to appear, I think, in the 1930s. And, you know, any way you could get up, there were things called boat tows, which would just be like a big sled, and people would stand or sit on the sled, and a rope would haul it up to the top. And so they invented all kinds of ways to get up and down the hill, or get up the hill. And but most of that didn't start till the 30s. And they would have other things. Sometimes a sleigh or a horse would get you up the hill. But the rope tows didn't start, and the lifts. And I'm forgetting when the first chairlift, what year that was, but it started at a place called Pioneer Ski Area near Crested Butte. And that was the first chairlift in Colorado. You know, I have another interesting ski jumping story, if you'd like to hear it. There was a ski jump at the town of Dillon in Summit County, and that the old town of Dillon is now underwater. But in 1919, the ski hill was kind of famous as a really good jumping hill. So a man named Anders Hagen came to Colorado and set the world ski jumping record there in 1919. He jumped 213 feet. And then he came back again a year later and set a new world record of 214 feet on the same hill. And he went on to become the captain of the first U.S. Olympic ski team for the first Winter Olympics in 1924 in Chamonix, France. And at that event, he had the longest jump of the whole Olympics, and they marked him down on style points because, get this, he leaned out over his skis. And that was not the proper form. So they marked him down, and he came in fourth place. And a Norwegian was given the bronze. And 50 years later, with the upcoming 50-year anniversary of the first Winter Olympics, an historian in Norway was researching and came across the original judges' scorecards or notebooks, whatever, and found a mathematical error and discovered that Anders Hagen had actually deserved the bronze medal. And so the man who had won the medal, and who had also won a couple other gold medals in other events at that Olympics, the daughter graciously agreed to give up the medal. And so they flew Anders Hagen, I think he was maybe 80 years old at the time, they flew him over to Norway and had a presentation and gave him his medal. And they corrected the record, and you can go look it up. And to this day, he is the only American to have ever won an Olympic ski jumping medal. And so 50 years after he had really earned the medal, he finally got it, and then he died not too many years after that.
I'm sorry, guys, I lost you. I hope the listeners were hearing you, because I completely lost you for, like, I don't know, it seemed like forever. And I don't know what's wrong. But if you were kept talking, that's great.
Yeah,
well, hopefully they
heard,
and I told the story of Anders Hagen in the 1924 Olympics.
Oh, wonderful.
And how
okay.
He, he won his medal, and then, or he didn't win the medal, but there was a mathematical error that they discovered 50 years later, and he had actually earned the bronze medal, and they gave him his ski jumping medal. And to date, he's the only U.S. skier to have ever earned a medal in ski jumping at the Olympics.
Oh, for goodness sakes. Well, at this point, I wanted to remind listeners, if we have listeners who just came into the show, and some do, come in at different points of the show, that you are listening to Step Into the Light right here on Blog Talk Radio. I'm your host, Patty Sheen. Our guests today are Karen and Peter Bodie. They have written a couple of books about lost ski areas in Colorado, and they have been very, very interesting to listen to. Unfortunately, I have lost my connection more than once. I hope listeners have not. I'm not sure what's going on. But the theme of this show is that listeners learn of the shadows that cross the lives of our guests. So what dark time did you experience that you would like to share with listeners today?
Well, Patty, I went through a very long wilderness time, and that included a lot of losses. I was a family caregiver, so I had a history of abuse also, but I had I was a family caregiver, taking care of my parents until they died, and taking care of others, all kinds of family members, until they died. And there was just a long, long wilderness time. I also was not able to find a full-time job. I was laid off in 2011 from a communications job, and I was writing on the side, you know. And I've always struck, kind of been a writer, but it's a hard way to make a living.
Mm-hmm.
And
I
needed a job. And I was not able to find a full-time job during the recession. I never found one. And so that was a long struggle, a long wilderness time. We were in debt and had financial struggles. So, and our kids were moving away. They were going on with their lives. And so it just was a trudge. And as I was taking care of my mom, I took care of her for 40 years. She had schizophrenia. So
oh,
it was
my.
A long caregiving stint.
I can relate to that, Karen, because I worked in psych for almost 40 years in nursing.
Oh, you did. Wow.
Uh-huh. Yeah, down here at the VA
well,
hospital.
Yeah, I cared for her
at,
for almost
Boys
40
Ranch.
Years.
Oh, wow.
And,
so, yes, you did carry a burden for a very, very long time, Karen. God bless you for that.
Well, it had its good moments, but it also was a long one, trudge. You know? So I was at the end of that. And God just gave us this little gift of this project for joy. You know, I really think that's what it was. And I wanted to honor him in it, even though it's for a general audience and for readers who are not necessarily people of faith. I wanted to honor the Lord in it. So I wrote this dedication: for the fun of skiing, for the people of skiing, for the sport of skiing, praise God. Which is very simple, but for the skiing audience, that's a totally different way of thinking.
Mm-hmm.
It's totally outside the box. So I wanted to honor him in this story, and that's how I chose to do it. But through this little project, he just gave us some joy. You know, he took us out and showed us also other people who had hard times, because the people who we were focusing on were hardworking people who also wanted to play some, but they did not have easy lives. And even running these little ski areas was difficult. And some of them were ranchers, and they just put the little bit extra out there for their kids or the kids in the community. And
mm-hmm.
they were people of faith. You could just tell they were people of faith. You know, you didn't have their stories of faith, but you could see the Lord in it. And there were people who had great tragedies. One family in the Guanella family lost a son building a ski area.
Oh,
and they
my.
Went ahead and, yeah, and they went ahead and built the area for the community. So it was just, they were just very inspiring people who also had very difficult times in their lives, and they kept going and they found a way to have some joy and some fun. And I think that's what this project really gave us.
And I would add that, well, I would add that when Karen spoke to the editor from History Press, she had been out of work for 3 years and was just really struggling because it's just was a difficult time to find a job, and especially when you're in your 50s, it's just harder. And
right.
So this project came along. We prayed about it because we kind of knew it was a lot of work, and we probably wouldn't be a big financial reward doing books like these.
Mm-hmm.
But
mm-hmm.
She said, well, I don't have a job. Let's just do this. And so we prayed about it and said, okay, let's go for it. And it was just a lot of fun, a lot of work, but a lot of fun in that we got to revisit parts of Colorado we hadn't seen in many years. We had done these hiking books about Colorado, The Hiker's Guide to Colorado, et cetera, and Hiking Colorado too. So we had really been all around the state, but you kind of get sucked into the suburban life and different things, and we'd go do things in the mountains and go skiing, and mostly cross-country skiing, but we had both done downhill all our lives, and with our kids we did a lot of downhill skiing, but we had kind of stopped downhill skiing once our son went off to start his own life, and so we kind
sure.
of stopped going as much except for the cross-country skiing. But here was this opportunity to just explore Colorado, and we went to places we hadn't been to in years, and it was just a joy for us, and it gave us a purpose
mm-hmm.
every weekend to just go and see this wonderful state and how blessed it is. And then on top of that, to discover these little interesting stories of these people who really were just down-to-earth people who loved skiing or just wanted to do something for their community and the kids in their area, and they just went for it. And some of them, they'd one rancher, you know, he just took a tractor and made a rope tow, used the tractor to power a rope tow, and others would take an old Buick, you know, or something and park it on the
yeah.
side of a hill and hook a rope tow to it. And,
yeah.
and some of them, the community aspect was just amazing because some of them were so low key that the price of skiing for the day was you had to bring a can of gas to run
mm-hmm.
the motor.
Boy.
And then we found in Yampa, Colorado, we found there had been a ski area there very early on, and not really a ski area. It was just something you walked up and skied down. They'd cut a run down through the oak brush from this little hill at the edge of town. But then later on, a local pastor decided he wanted to do something for especially the boys in town, and the long winters in a ranch town, you know, there's a lot to get in trouble.
Oh, yeah.
And so he started a little club and a youth group kind of thing and redid the ski area and got a rope tow, et cetera, and got some funding. And so anyway, that was, you know, that was a faith. It was a ski area built on a faith and a youth pastor encouraging kids to do some healthy fun.
Wow, how amazing, huh? Well, I wanted to tell you, I was going to tell you before, and then I got all off track, losing my connection back there. You said you were raised in Connecticut, Peter. When I was a kid, I had a great aunt and uncle who had a farm up there, and I can remember my folks bought me a pair of skis. We had a very small ski area, would you believe, out on Long Island, of all places. It was called Bond Ridge. Yeah, but when we'd go up to Connecticut, my uncle's farm was, there was some really hilly areas, and when they had a good snow up there, I can remember my dad would, I would ski down the hill, and my dad would stand behind me and push me. back up the hill so I could ski down again. And I think, oh my goodness, you know, that took a lot of energy back then.
We had a ski hill behind my house across the big field, and I looked back on it. I went back and looked at the map, and I think the elevation change in it was something on the order of 40 feet.
Yeah.
But, and I didn't know there was such a thing as cross-country skiing and downhill skiing or whatever. You cross-country skied across the field to get to the slope, and then you did what we call the herringbone, walking up and
yes.
packing the slope,
yes.
and then you'd ski down. And,
yep.
and the first time my parents took, I have four older brothers, so, and many uncles and aunts had lived in the family house. So when you needed ski equipment, you went up into the attic and found something that fit you. And if you were lucky, it was, you know, maybe a pretty new pair of skis that one of your brothers or cousin had gotten, you know, for their 16th birthday or something.
Exactly.
Or
yes.
It was something one of your uncles had used back in the 30s. You know? and so there was a wide variety of ski equipment. But you just did it. And the first time I went to a real skier, it was called Mohawk Mountain in northern Connecticut. My next older brother and I went, and our parents took us. And I don't know if it was that our parents didn't have a lot of money, and when they got there, they were kind of shocked by the cost of a lift ticket, or if we were just so intimidated by the rope tow and the chairlift. But either way, we went to sort of what they call the bunny hill, the beginner's slope, and we walked up it and skied down and had the greatest fun because this hill was four times the size of our hill behind the house. And so my first
thought, wow.
visit to a ski area, we walked up and skied down.
Well, I can.
And then I came to Colorado. I came to Colorado to partly for the skiing, and went to school in Fort Collins at CSU,
oh,
and
okay.
that's where I met Karen.
Uh huh. Well, I can remember going up to Monarch. You mentioned the glory of this state and all the beauty that God has provided here. And I can remember when my kids and I would go up to Monarch, and I'm not kidding, there were days when I didn't do more than 5 or 6 runs in the whole day, and I really didn't care. I would just get to the top of that. There was one, I can't remember the name of it now, there was one trail, and I swear to goodness, you look out, and you just feel like you're on top of the world. Because you're so high up. I believe it was on the divide, actually. And,
yes,
I mean, I could spend 20, 30 minutes just stay out of the way of everybody else, you know. Or there were times coming down the trail, I would just pull off and kind of stand up in the trees where I was out of the way of the real skiers and just admire the beauty around me because it is just so overwhelming and so awesome that I could spend the whole day just enjoying doing that.
Well, I agree with that.
I still do that. I stop for the view.
You just stop, huh? Just stop and appreciate
yep.
what's there.
Yep.
So I think you've pretty much told us how that project was a blessing before and after publication, that you met so many fantastic people, and it was something that occupied your mind, Karen, and helped heal your heart because you were really suffering
yeah.
from some tough times. What would you say was the most surprising thing about creating the two books? And by the way, I didn't tell listeners once again, you guys' website, because I got disconnected. Website is Lost Ski Areas of Colorado for folks who would like to do some further research on Karen and Peter's work, and also on my website, which is pattysheen.com, that's spelled P-A-T-T-I-S-H-E-N-E. You'll be able to find their information also on the website and social media page that I have under the Blog Talk Radio tab. So go ahead, Karen. Wanted to get that in before
right.
end of every time here.
We're a .com too. And
yes.
Well, I think the most surprising thing was that we didn't know about the story of these humble people. We knew, at least I grew up skiing the I-70 ski areas. I started at Loveland when I was 5, and then Vail and Aspen and so on. So I had no idea about this story. It was a total learning experience. Very surprising that these humble people started the ski industry in Colorado.
Mm-hmm.
It was like, you know, because yes. Current resorts are so huge and so much about money and partying and so on. But the underpinnings of all of that was, I've discovered, was the humble people, the tradesmen and the ranchers and who wanted to create skiing for fun for their communities and especially for the children. And it was just a total surprise.
I know today's ski industry is so different.
Yeah.
Another surprise was that we had heard the story about the Tent Mountain Division that had trained in Colorado during World War II, and how after the war, those men came back to not just Colorado, but other places around the country, New England and out west and California. And many of those people were responsible for starting the big ski areas that we think of today. And so we just had assumed that that's where the real history of skiing started. We knew about Father Dyer and his skiing, you know, between the mountain mining camps. But we didn't really realize how much had come before that. And that was a big learning experience to discover all these other areas that, I mean, you could go to a town in the mountains and say, we're looking for information. Does anybody know about the ski area at the edge of town? And sometimes people would just say, there was a ski area at the edge of town. You know, they give you this complete puzzled look because some of these went back in the teens and 20s and 30s, and they are long forgotten. And it was fun to just pursue that and then finding, well, so-and-so that's down at the grocery store, they've been around a long time, they might know something. And then you talk to them and they say, well, I never was a skier, but my, you know, my cousin so-and-so was, and here's their phone number. And then all of a sudden you'll, and sometimes you went down this road and you never got anywhere, but sometimes you'd finally get that one person and they'd been waiting, you know, 50 years for someone to ask them that question.
Wow.
About the ski area. And it turned out their uncle was the one who, you know, who built the rope tow or something. And mm-hmm. so all of a sudden you just hit this mother load of information. And it was a joy for them to be able to tell that story.
And
it was a joy for us to listen to it.
Oh, how neat. I had a similar experience with research. We had this little grocery store. We have it's a quarterly magazine that our Pioneer Historical Society of Bent County does. And they had asked me to write a story about a grocery store that existed years ago here. And I went to the nursing home and I met a couple of the ladies over there. And oh, my goodness. I mean, they just came up with a plethora of information. The lady that had assigned me the article didn't even know that the grocery store had started out in what they called the Colonia out by Fort Lyon, where a lot of the Hispanic people lived, you know. I mean, it was it was so fun doing that. So I know exactly what you're talking about on a much smaller scale.
Oh, that's neat.
Well, folks, we had said that you didn't think that we could fill up an hour. We are down to 6 minutes left. And the last question I wanted to ask you before we say goodbye is, what is your next project? Do you guys have another project in mind? And do you know at this point, or are you just kind of waiting for the Lord to bring something else to you like he did these projects?
Well, I feel like he had me do some history, so I'm looking for someone to do a biography on. But I am asking the Lord to bring it to me, as I learned from this project. that's
yes.
a really good idea to wait and just ask him, what's the next thing you want me to do, Lord? What can I write for you? And so I am waiting, but I'm also keeping my antenna up for a biography, possibly, or a next project. I'm also doing some fiction writing. I do I finished the first novel, and I'm the president of the South Denver chapter of the Association of Christian Fiction Writers, serving for a year.
Oh, congratulations.
So, yeah, so that's a fun thing to do, and we're going to have a conference in October. But anyway, so just waiting to see what the Lord wants to do.
Mm-hmm. Are you going back to CCWC, Karen? That's where I met you last
year. I don't think I'm going this year, but I might go for a day.
Okay.
Uh-huh.
Well, yeah, you're close
going?
Enough. Yeah, I'm going. Well, Marlene has me on faculty again.
Oh, good.
So I get to talk about my show.
Yeah, that's good.
And get new people.
Wonderful show.
I really count on her to, you know, to allow me to pitch the show and take appointments and tell people what I have to offer. So yeah, that's been wonderful. In fact, I'd say probably at least 75% of the people I've had on the show are people I know through Marlene.
Well, that's
so
where I'm at, yeah.
She has been a real blessing to me, let me tell you. If it weren't for her, I ran into some problems with the other show I used to do, and I was pretty discouraged, and she was the one who said, "You're not giving this up because the Lord is going to pull you through this," and she was right.
God bless her.
So, yeah. So, well, it's been wonderful having the both of you on the show. Again, I'd like to remind listeners to check out Karen and Peter's website, LostSkiAreasOfColorado.com, and check out their books. I'm sure they're available on Amazon.
Yep.
Is that not right? Yeah, as well.
That's
as...
Yep,
right.
And in bookstores.
And in bookstores. Oh, cool. Very good. So, well, I want to thank you both, and it's just been a real delight to have you here. And I'm sorry that we're getting toward the end of the ski season, but maybe we have whetted some appetites for the beginning of next year's ski season. I heard on the news last night there's a couple of places that will be open until around the 22nd of April, but a lot of them are getting ready to wind down now. So,
well, it seems to come around every year, so that's fine.
Yes, it does. So, again, thanks so much, and God bless you both, and I'll be in touch.
Thanks, Patty. God bless you.
Thank you.
For our listeners, in closing, when you look back on the dark periods in your life, you may find they were not quite as dark as they seemed at the time. And when the light does shine again, it is so much brighter than you remembered. Hope to have you back with us next week, Tuesday morning, the 5th of April, I believe that will be, at 8 o'clock Mountain Daylight Time. God bless you all. Thank you for listening.
There is a candle in every soul, some brightly burning, some dark and cold. There is a spirit who brings a fire, ignites a